From the land of Grand Teton University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report, our Conservation Agriculture Special. Today, we'll pull from the Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast, which you can find on our website at willag.org under the podcast link. Today's conversation is all about conservation with farmers. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with a farmer and a PhD student that are both trying to figure out how to move more fully into conservation methods on the farm. We'll start with Chris Morris. He is a PhD candidate in rural sociology and sustainable agriculture at Iowa State University. I began by asking him to tell us a little bit about himself and why he was interested in the intersection between rural sociology and sustainable agriculture.
So before grad school, I worked for 15 years in Texas as a conservationist with the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. And so I worked in the field with farmers developing conservation plans and administering conservation programs.
How does that differ, I suspect, from what you find in the field in Iowa as it relates to the conservation measures that are deployed?
Iowa and Texas are very similar in terms of the resource concerns that we're looking at. So soil quality, soil erosion, water quality, wildlife habitat, air quality, things like that. Obviously, the cropping systems are different. So the farmers that I worked with in Texas generally did a corn, sorghum, cotton rotation, whereas a lot of the farmers in Iowa do more of a corn and beans rotation, and sometimes just corn on corn. So it's a different cropping system, different climate, but at the heart of it, the conservation practices are very similar.
Can you tell me about the research you're currently working on?
Yeah, so I came to grad school at ISU to basically use my experience as a conservation professional working in the field with farmers to inform my research, and I also want to teach the next generation of conservationists. So I study social and structural factors that influence farmer adoption of conservation practices, and how we can best use programs, policies, education, and technical assistance to encourage and support farmers to grow our food, fiber, and fuel more sustainably. And so my major professor is Dr. Jay Arbuckle, and he and I have been working together for the past 4 years on factors that influence conservation adoption.
Things like what?
Yeah, so I've had three major projects that might be of interest. And so one of those studies was looking at the effect of NRCS conservation plans on conservation practice adoption. And what we found with that one was that it wasn't actually conservation plans that made the difference, but that multiple interactions with conservation professionals over time through technical assistance was actually the most consistent predictor of conservation practice adoption. So in other words, building a relationship of trust over time between a conservation practitioner and a farmer was the thing that made the most positive impact on getting conservation on the ground. I thought that was really neat. I also worked with the Soil and Water Conservation Society on a project called the Conservation Practitioner Poll, where we surveyed conservation practitioners from across six different Midwestern states. And again, one of the main findings from that project is that, according to conservation professionals, it's one-on-one technical assistance, preferably in the field with farmers, that contributes the most to success as far as getting conservation on the ground. Interestingly, what the conservation practitioners told us is that that's usually the thing that they get to spend the least amount of time on in their jobs, and yet it's the thing that they find the most effective for getting conservation established. I thought that was interesting. And then part of my dissertation is also looking at how experiences of trauma can affect farmer decision making. So things like floods, droughts, on-farm injuries, the 80s farm crisis, increasingly relying on agricultural inputs that are always increasing in price, having to go through boom and bust commodity markets, even stress over time itself can be traumatic. And what we're finding is that these potentially traumatic experiences can have a real effect on farmer decision making, particularly when it comes to risk aversion.
Have you checked to see if there's a difference in farmer decision making and landlord decision making?
Yeah, so that's not specifically in my wheelhouse, but I have looked at some of the research around that. And we know that sometimes a landowner will have very different goals on their property than potentially a farmer does. We also know that farmers who are leasing, that are renting land, may not feel they may not feel confident installing conservation practices on a piece of land that they might not have control over in the long term. And so there is a little bit of a disconnect there. However, there's lots of really awesome stories of landowners and farmers working together where both parties feel like, again, going back to that trust factor, that they're developing a relationship of trust where they can make sure that both of their needs are met and they're doing the best thing for the land.
What are the largest barriers to adoption?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's a big focus of the research area that I'm involved in. I do want to give a shout out to a couple of researchers, Pranay Ranjan and Linda Prokopy, who have done a lot of work looking at doing review studies of basically the scientific literature from the past several decades on barriers and motivations for conservation adoption. And kind of the three top factors that they have found in terms of barriers. Number one is economics, which we hear a lot. Number two is incorporating new practices into farm management. That can be difficult. And then we also know number three, there's a really high effect of social pressure on farmers. And if I can, I want to talk about the economics part because a lot of times people will just hear that and say, they will think that farmers may be reluctant to install conservation practices because of the cost of those practices or the potential for reduced income. But my research looking into trauma has actually found that the story is a lot deeper than that. It's not just that farmers might have a decrease in their yield and therefore their income. Anyone that works with farmers know that a lot of farmers are working on very thin profit margins from year to year. And in many years, many farmers will actually take a loss. And so what that means is that doing something new, incorporating new conservation practices into their farm management, not only is that risky, but if they potentially have a failure, a catastrophic failure, and something goes really wrong, it's not just that they might have a loss of income, they might be at risk of losing the farm. And farmers are not just, farming is not just a job to farmers, it's a way of life. And many of these farmers are working on land that may have been in their family for several generations. And so the thought of doing something potentially risky, doesn't just come down to simple economics, it comes down to the risk of, again, potentially losing their way of life and losing a family legacy.
Have you seen a difference in adoption rates when a farmer is approached by a farmer as opposed to when a farmer is approached by a professional?
So I haven't seen any literature that specifically looks at the difference between adoption rates of farmers approached by a conservation professional versus another farmer. But I do know that both of those approaches are really important depending on the farmer. So we know that, again, going back to these relationships of trust, which keep coming up as a main factor in my research, a lot of times farmers will trust other farmers more so than they will a conservation professional that's maybe coming from a government agency. And so being able to network with other farmers, ask them questions about how they implemented a certain practice, what things went wrong, what they would recommend doing in the future. A lot of times that's a lot easier avenue for them to begin to explore using a practice as opposed to a conservation professional coming in and just recommending something like that. That's one of the reasons that field days and workshops are really important where you can get farmers together. And I think that when conservation professionals attend those field days as well. They're also helping to build those relationships of trust, not only with farmers, but between farmers. So yeah, I think that's something that can be really productive.
You mentioned a couple of things there that are probably successful techniques to increase the adoption of conservation practices. What other things might there be available?
going back to my research, it really comes down to relationships of trust. We know that there are a wide variety of factors that influence human behavior, and human behavior is really complicated. It's one of the hardest things to model. But we do know that trust has a huge factor on behavior outcomes. And so what I would recommend to conservation professionals is to do the work of having multiple interactions with farmers over time, one-on-one, face-to-face, in the field, if possible. We know from conservation practitioner experience, as well as talking to farmers, that that's something that really has a positive impact on conservation adoption. And it's important that conservation professionals don't just leave it there, in terms of developing a conservation plan, getting a practice installed, and then walking away. You really have to come back and review those principles with the farmer, do some follow-up, and make sure that they are integrating those practices successfully into their overall farm management. And then on the farmer side, I think we have an interesting phenomenon called the coffee shop effect. We know that in rural communities, farmers talk to each other. A lot of times they'll gather at the coffee shop and they'll sort of interrogate each other about what they're doing. So maybe one farmer tries implementing cover crops, and he might hear other farmers say, your fields are looking pretty weedy there. Or maybe another farmer tries no-till, and someone might tell her, your fields are looking kind of trashy. Those are words that I've heard from farmers. And so if the farmer that has tried a new practice is willing to engage with his or her peers and say, well, actually, it's not weedy out there. I've incorporated a multi-species cover crop that is benefiting my soil health and reducing the amount of nitrogen that I have to put on the field every year. And they can kind of come at it from a conversational standpoint. They can use those relationships of trust to have an influence on farmers in their community. We also see the effect of farmers, driving by their neighbors, looking at their fields, seeing what they're doing. And I would encourage farmers to reach out to their neighbors and say, hey, would you like to come onto my place and talk about what I'm doing? Obviously, there's a little bit of risk in opening yourself up like that, but I think if we're going to make a difference in soil and water conservation in the Midwest, all of us are going to have to do things that are inherently a little bit more risky. And I think ultimately, if that contributes to relationships of trust, that can be a positive impact.
Chris Morris is a PhD candidate in rural sociology and sustainable agriculture at Iowa State University. Now, on the subject of weedy fields and being able to put yourself in front of farmers, your peers, if you are a farmer, and talk about what's happening in your field, Steve Staker has done just that. He's in Mercer County, where he farms in West Central Illinois. I asked him to tell us a little bit about himself and what he does.
We farm about 1,600 acres, my brother, son, and I. We've been pretty much implementing cover crops now on all of our acres, with the exception if we don't get a field seeded or something in the fall because of weather. But for probably a period of 10 years, we've got some rougher ground that was terraced in the early 80s, so we have those practices. Like I say, we have started out kind of small, just hit and miss, and then when my son kind of came into the operation, why we just went 100%, and we've had our sharp learning curves along the way.
And are you along the river then?
Yes, we're located Aledo. Aledo is my address, and we're located about 15 miles from the Mississippi.
Can you tell me a little bit about the advanced soil health training you attended?
The advanced soil health training was a 6-session. It was a group of farmers, retailers, consultants, and we were taught by several knowledgeable individuals from NRCS and private companies that about the biology in the soil and the cover crop implementation of things, you know, how to implement cover crops, what their goal is, and then got clear into the how the cover crop affects the biological activities in the soil.
Anything that you learned that you put into practice on your own farm, whether that was from another farmer or from the NRCS folks and others who would have been the professionals?
We had been pretty much all cereal rye as our cover crop. This year, however, we did, after going through this training, we did do some winter barley ahead of corn, just kind of to try that as another, oh, I don't want to say another species, or, you know, will the barley work better than the rye ahead of corn? So we did implement that. I do have, with another company, we seeded 60 acres of pennycress, which was seeded late in the cold weather. I'm not expecting miracles out there, but see how it goes. If we can advance along here and have the cover crop be a cash crop ahead of soybeans, why, I think that would be an advantage too. So.
You've been using cover crops for a while now. I take it you like them and you think they help your systems?
Well, we originally started looking at the cover crop not so much from a weed control or a biological improvement, more of a erosion control implementation, because we were getting a lot of from a lot of rough ground, having a lot of erosion over the winter. And then once we started doing the cover crop, we've seen the other advantages of the weed control and the increased biological activities and stuff. Once a guy gets started, you know, then you see the other benefits start to kind of fall into place.
No-till wasn't enough to hold the soil in place.
No, we couldn't hold it with no-till. It wasn't too bad, you know, as far as corn on corn. We still had some erosion, but, you know, if we were following a soybean crop or something, why, yeah, on the rougher terrains, we just could not hold the soil. So that's kind of what we, like I say, originally started the process with. And then, of course, then all the other advantages kind of fell into place.
What are the things you've learned over the years as it relates to putting a cover crop in the ground, and terminating it that you think other farmers should know?
Well, probably the biggest thing that we've learned is about the time you get it figured out, you find out you don't have it figured out. In 2019, we had a really wet spring, and we were planting green, and everything, all the equipment just set for the month of May because of wet weather. When we got back in the field to plant corn, the rye was 5 foot tall. So, you know, we learned, had a real sharp learning curve that year. It turned out okay. I think it hurt our yield some, but I'm not you know, looking back at the situation, we probably didn't, it was, some of it was self-inflicted too. So, but the biggest, you know, as far as getting it in, we are not a fan of aerial application just because of sporadic stands and stuff, which this year, due to labor, we aerial seeded about 500 acres, and I'm still not a fan of it. You know, it just didn't work. So we primarily drill, or this year we're using a split row planter. We're still seeding. We generally seed until snow or frost keeps us out. And if it doesn't come up this winter, it'll grow next spring type philosophy. We just got to get something out there. You know, that's my and my son's gut feeling on the situation. You know, don't matter how you do it. There's a lot of different ways to implement them. They all work, but just got to do something.
How do you use the split row planter?
It's just set on 15 inch. It's a Kinze split row. We put a wheat plate or a cover crop plate in it, and this is our first year with that. Prior to this, we was just using a grain drill. We had a 30-foot sunflower drill, and we decided we didn't like the drill for soybeans, so we decided to get rid of the drill and go to the 15-inch rows, and then just do our rye in 15 inches also. I'll have a idea of what I think about it. From what I see right now, it's fine. You know, we got a good stand. our rates were down, 40 pounds or less on a rate just to control the cost. I think it's going to do everything we want to do.
Do you use that with GPS, and will you try to plant between the rows when you come back in?
We are not using it based, with an RTK system. I think that would be ideal, but the tractor we're drill or planting with does not have it, and it's an awful big investment, so we just opted not to go that route. But yes, I do agree that probably, at least with corn planting, I think that would be a very viable option.
Anything from the NRCS folks that you found of interest that you haven't put into place yet, or that you've thought a lot about since you took the training?
Well, they're all pushing multi-species cover crops, which I do not disagree with. But due to our geographic location, the only way to do a multi-species would be aerial seeding. And like I say, I am not a big fan of aerial seeding. So that was probably their biggest push, get everybody looking at having different species seeded out there. Like I say, I don't disagree with it. They just not have not found a way to implement it.
Why did they want that to be the case? Do you know?
Well, different crops have different biological impacts. So, the multi-species may give you a little bit of a boost, as far as the microbial actions or the uptake of residual nutrients out there.
Do you have any advice for the conservation professionals about how they should reach out to farmers?
From my viewpoint, I'm not really a high pressure person. So, as far as reaching out to these guys, and really trying to put a lot of pressure on them to do it, that's not the way I don't function good under those types of scenarios. I think people need encouragement, and then they need the resources to make it happen. And I think farmer needs to know if there's a downside to it, which there can be. We have, like I say, we have experienced that. We didn't let it get to the point that it soured us on the cover crop programs or anything. So,
Steve Staker is a farmer from Mercer County, Illinois. He tells me that he puts his acres dedicated to conservation, and almost all of them are, especially the experimental ones, right out on the road where farmers can see them and ask him questions. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. This has been our Talking Conservation with Farmers special edition. You can find it as well in the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast. Look for episode number 48 online at willag.org under the podcast tab. You have a good afternoon. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.